The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
I'd like to speak to you comparatively simply this afternoon on the Christian faith and the coming conflict of civilizations. A couple of times in the last 10 years, I was invited to Uppsala in Sweden, once to lecture at the university. If you've ever been there, it's a lovely 18th century university. But on the outskirts of the town, there's a place called Gamla Uppsala, the old Uppsala, which is extremely interesting. And people go there because there's three huge burial mounds, about 1,500 years old, where three great Norse kings were buried with their boats after a Viking expedition, dedicated to the gods Woden and Thor and Frey. And it's fascinating because there's been human civilization there for about 7,000 years. And it's rich in weaponry and all that sort of thing archaeologically. But what's most moving is that about 1,100, the first church of Christ was founded there. And for 100 years, the last pagan temple and the first church coexisted. So here was the center where about 75 human beings, every sacrificial moment, the vernal equinox or whatever, were killed. And the pagan sacrifices were almost at their end. And 100 yards away, the first church. And for about a century, we're told, they coexisted. And you could almost feel the sort of struggle of God and the gods. Elijah and the prophets of Baal in a European setting. The war of the worlds and the worldviews. But then, of course, the church and the gospel triumphed and paganism receded. But it's very moving to see this because at the end of it, the guide suddenly turns and she says, and today it's all reversed. The churches in Sweden, empty. Paganism is on the rise. Now, if you look around much of the world and think back a few hundred years, if we stop the clock about 1900, you could say the Church of Christ was dominant only in one continent in great strength. And that, her adopted continent, Europe, and the places where Europeans had gone, like North America. But not the rest of the world. And yet 100 years later, the church is truly described as the world's first nearly universal religion. And one of the weakest places of all is where for so long she was so strong, Europe. In other words, on the one hand, you have a stunning reversal. And on the other hand, a surprising reawakening. Because again, if 100 years ago you were to say, how is the Christian church and the gospel going in the world? Many people would have seen the parallel advance of the gospel and all the West and modernization. Coming across other civilizations that were somewhat more backward, often with religions that were considered somewhat patronizingly as moribund. And 100 years later, these civilizations are rising again, including in many cases the religion at their core. So as we come towards the end of this century, the Church of Christ, on the one hand, faces the enormous challenge of all that's represented by modernity. And on the other hand, all that's represented by newly awakened civilizations and ancient religions as they too interact with modernity. And that's what I want to speak about this afternoon. I stress, this is going to be fast, sweeping, somewhat superficial. But I'd like just to paint in some of the broad contours of a discussion which will probably increase as we go into the next century. And I think this is just the sort of glimpses of it as I see at the moment. Let me set it out in terms of 9 or 10 propositions. Proposition one. There are three major revolutions that make up the challenge of modernity to the church. In 1989, some of us had the privilege of being at the Lausanne Congress on Mission in Manila. And I was asked to speak there on mission and modernity. And they gave me 20 minutes, and I poured out my heart. And I remember finishing, going out afterwards into the foyer. And there was an elderly missionary lady who came up to me and sort of accosted me. And she said, "I didn't hear everything you said, and I didn't understand all that I did hear. But let me ask you one question. Why did they ask a man to speak about maternity?" I find there's incredible confusion on this point. I mean, even the pronunciation. I'm on sort of two or three radio things around Christian radio every week. And I should think at least 50% of the time they say, "And you're too interested in modernity." And even the word is sort of strange, whatever modernity is. Now, let me put it like this. Mostly when we think of human history, we think of civilizations. I don't know which ones you'd include, the Persian and the Assyrian, the Chaldean, the Indian, the Inca, and the Greeks and the Romans, and so on and so on. But in each case, they're largely tied to an area of the world and inevitably somewhat transient. And yet one of the great differences of modernity, which of course is not unique, but it is truly the first nearly universal civilization, and unquestionably the most powerful civilization in human history so far, and not tied just to a continent or to one particular religion and ideology. And by the three great revolutions, I mean simply capitalism, going back the furthest, industrialized technology, going back to the 18th century in Britain, and modern telecommunications, going back to the 19th century, particularly here in the United States. Now, when you say that, our place in that is obvious. And in a way, because it's flattering, we're aware of it. In other words, the 20th century is the American century, and America is the lead nation in the modernizing process, the radiating center from which modernity is spreading out, just as the 19th century was largely the British century. But what many Christians don't go on to see is the enormous challenge in that. So just take capitalism, which many Christians and many conservatives see as a thoroughly conservative force. And so the tie-in, say, between business and capitalism is common and often unthinking. And yet, as many thinkers have pointed out, capitalism is probably the most corrosive solvent of tradition in all human history. Peter Berger, for instance, who's a strong advocate of capitalism, argues that capitalism now faces its greatest challenge with the fall of the Soviet Union. It's beaten back the aristocratic questions, it's beaten back the aesthetic questions, it's now beaten back the socialist challenges, and now faces its greatest question of all, which is capitalism. In other words, capitalism has a tendency to undermine the very virtues which are needed for capitalism itself to survive. And with no challenges, in many ways, capitalism in the form of what Beller has called market totalitarianism could be the greatest challenge to tradition and virtues and values the West has yet seen. So those three revolutions are not to be taken for granted. And many Christians grapple with a challenge of ideas, but not with a challenge of revolutions like that. Proposition two. There are three great laboratory experiments that demonstrate the interaction of modernity with civilizations. After 1989, there was a lot of discussion of who killed communism. And at first and throughout, the major answer was democratic ideals. And that, of course, was extremely significant. Increasingly, and not only among people of faith, the second answer was faith itself. The Protestants in East Germany, Catholics in Poland, the Protestants and Orthodox in the Soviet Union. And there's no question that gradually that angle was picked up by more and more people. But the overlooked angle usually was modernity itself. Because in a way, nothing has acted more powerfully as a gigantic can opener to closed societies, whether traditional closed societies or modern totalitarian societies, than modernity with all its travel and technology and media and so on. Now, before the fall of the Soviet Union, there was a lot of discussion that the three main laboratory experiments were these. Western democratic capitalism, totalitarian socialism, and East Asian capitalism. Obviously, the middle one is gone, but if you look at those three, the first was the oldest, coming out of a Jewish and mainly Christian background, being openly in favor of the modern world and all that modernizing means. The second, then, was totalitarian socialism, 150 years younger, coming out of a Marxist, not a Christian background, and being very ambivalent about the modern world. On the one hand, pretending to be a science. On the other hand, in many ways, recapitulating traditional society, but with modern totalitarian control and tyranny. And the third, the youngest, East Asian capitalism, coming out of a Confucian and a Buddhist background, and like the first, the West, being basically committed to going with the flow of modernity in a non-ambivalent way. Now, clearly, the second is gone. And very few serious thinkers see any of the remaining forms of Marxist countries as capable of being an experiment for the future. The third would move to the second place, and today the concentration would be on Islam. But what's interesting is how many countries, quite explicitly, they're saying the first experiment has failed. More specifically, that it's the religious, ideological, and moral component of the first that has failed. So, for example, I was in Singapore a few years back where the so-called Singapore School were arguing that the Christian faith had given rise to the modern world, but had failed to either guide it or restrain it. So the modern world had clearly run away with the West, and that was the reason behind the chaos in the West. But Singapore would not make the same mistake. With a semi-paternalistic control, a la Lee Kuan Yew, using explicit Confucian values and worldview with a higher place for tradition, a stronger place for the collective, a powerful foundation for the family, they would not make the mistake of the West, and modernity would be guided by the Confucian-Buddhist worldview. The same argument is even more explicit in China. And Deng Xiaoping says, we will not go the way of Gorbachev. Suddenly opened up with perestroika, he brought the whole of the Soviet Union down. We will have this controlled experiment. On the one hand, bringing back Confucianism, which had been assigned to history, and now was brought back in and taken much more seriously, somewhat alongside Marxism. On the other hand, opening up parts of China, southern China, to controlled experiments with capitalism so that an authoritarian framework they would, in China, guide the use of modernization into the next century when they would be able to take over from the West. So very self-consciously, they see themselves as alternative experiments of this engagement of modernity and ancient civilizations. And very self-consciously, they see themselves as alternatives to the failure of the Christian church, and specifically the failure of the church to control the challenge of modernity in the West. Proposition 3. In this situation, Islam represents a very special challenge to us. One hardly needs to expand on this in any depth because it's so obvious. Geopolitically, for a start, the very place geographically where they sit has always been that place between Europe and Asia. And that bridging role in the great game in many other periods has been enormously significant, let alone with the addition of all the petrotechnology and the wealth that's there today. But at a more important level, there's the religious challenge. Because in many ways, as a Christian heresy, they are the closest to us and the least different, like the Eastern religions are, with a similar universal claim, with a similar claim to an absolute truth, to being a final revelation, to having the last word, to relying on crusades, or in their sense, the jihad. And you can see in many ways that part of the challenge of Islam is precisely their closeness and yet their difference despite the closeness. And we all know in this country how in those who are despairing of the churches, say in the inner city, the appeal of Islam has been so extraordinarily powerful. And one could add to the geopolitical and the religious reasons a third dimension, historical reasons. For example, there's no question that historians have said that before the Christian faith was truly a universal religion, particularly in the late 19th, 20th century, Islam could lay claim to that many centuries earlier. And there have probably been more centuries when Islam has been a threat politically and geopolitically to the Church of Christ than the Church of Christ has been to Islam. And the long history of those struggles, as with the story of our relationship with the Jews, colors many of our relationships today in ways that are very vivid, and present. Proposition 4. Three needed perspectives on history. If you look at the various perspectives on history and on offer today, I always think it's not one or the other that's important, but in some ways being able to shift from one to the other. So for a lot of people, history is short term, the recent past, a matter of events, years, decisive battles, important leaders, decades at most. To others, though, it's the medium term that's more important, the more remote past, not years or decades, but convergences and turning points and long ideas and big ideas like the Renaissance and the Enlightenment. But then there's those historians who have the really, really long term, the so-called reflective past, where the focus is on continents and civilizations and geographies and religions. Now, if you take those, clearly the scripture moves between those three quite easily, with an extraordinary stress on the dailiness of Christian obedience, and yet a long-term view of history, say, in the book of Daniel, to put it mildly. Or you can say the Europeans have a much greater ease in moving between the three, or the Japanese, for example. Or you could say our American framers did, very aware of what was needing to be done today, and with an amazing sense of standing above history and having an enormous vision of the flow of history and the rise and fall of the classical republics of Greece and Rome and so on. But Americans today, by and large, only the first, at a time when it's the others that are equally needed. So Bill Moyer says, in the light of things like CNN, Americans today know everything about the last 24 hours. Not that much about the last 24 years, and next to nothing about the last 24 centuries. Now, it isn't one or the other, as I was saying, but the ability to move from one to the other and have a glimpse of all of them is really crucial in our time. Proposition 5. Three global trends and reactions carried by modernity, which will be significant in this coming clash. The first is geopolitical, second philosophical, and third ethical. Geopolitically, the shift that's been variously described as from totalitarianism to tribalism, which is really an underlying shift from a swing towards centralization to a counter swing towards decentralization, which you see around much of the world, which is represented so strongly in tribalism. It's put in various ways. Sometimes people say that a generation ago in America, the average person had a strong sense of the little institution behind them, the family, and the big institution above them, the government. But now you can see on the one hand, the family has collapsed and the government has suffered a crisis of confidence. In other parts of the world, parts of Africa, you have the new phenomena of the so-called failed states, where the governments have collapsed not just in confidence, but altogether. And many people taking to an identification with the middle-level groupings of tribalism. At its worst in things like Rwanda or parts of the Bosnian situation, but here we have our own politics of identity, our own systematic organization of group grievances and hatreds. And you can see that this, which is flowing throughout much of the modern world, is a very important current in our world, is a current the church has to ride very carefully. Church growth people tell us about the homogeneous unit principle, the birds of a feather principle. And certainly churches grow well, grow fast, practicing that principle, which is sociologically realistic, and yet theologically a contradiction of all that the gospel means in terms of reconciliation and the breaking down of bridges and barriers between people. The second trend and reaction is philosophical. The shift, which you know well, between modernism and postmodernism. And again, you can see this in many parts of the modernized world, and not only here in the United States. Again, this is a discussion that's far too big for a second or two. But my view of it would be, and I'm sure some of you share this, that it's a mistake to equate modernism with modernity. Modernism is a set of ideas, sometimes described accurately as the so-called Enlightenment Project, with a grand belief in reason and science and progress, summed up in the 60s cry that God is dead and man has come of age. Modernism is important as a set of ideas, and it has collapsed. But it's not modernity, because modernity is more than ideas. It includes these great revolutions, capitalism, industrialized technology, and so on. And seen that way, modernity is at its high noon, even as modernism, the set of ideas, has collapsed. So to see the collapse of modernism is not to hail the triumph of the gospel over modernity, merely to see that we've shifted in the area of ideas from modernism to postmodernism. But modernity as a whole is as powerful as ever, if not more powerful. The third shift is the ethical shift. Again, much commented on. So that right and wrong has gone from being seen as something defined theistically to something being defined legally as crime, to something being defined psychologically as sickness, or increasingly now as low self-esteem. And it's really striking in this country, which is a country that has the doctrine of original sin through John Witherspoon and others institutionally at its core. And yet we have some of the most trivialized, romanticized, sentimental views of evil that the Western world has ever seen, often in the name of the church, and many of them in Christian bookstores. Proposition 6. Three cultural shifts carried within the modernity, which we have to wrestle with, or all civilizations will. The graphics revolution, the information revolution, and the marketing revolution. The significance of the graphics revolution is surely that it's led to the triumph of images over words. So if we go back 200 years, most people lived with very few images. A few museums, the wealthy with paintings in their homes, but most people, most of time, relating basically to nature. And now, through the rise of such things as the graphics revolution and the photograph and the ability to reproduce, images everywhere, and words, which are exploding too, largely used as accessories to images without the domination they used to have. Now, I don't need to undermine that here at Westminster with your tremendous theology of the word. I was struck by this forcibly when a rabbi was said to me out in California, "We Jews realize that we have a stake in words. Theologically, we are people of the word. Democratically, we realize that words are critical to truth and freedom and our security." He said, "It alarms me to see how you Christians are just following the triumph of images without a question. You should be people of words like we are." I think he's right. You go around much of the church and hear truisms like "a picture's worth a thousand words" and all sorts of things raised totally uncritically, to see that even in the church, the graphics revolution has led to the same triumph. The information revolution surely means the triumph of information over wisdom. Daniel Boorstin has argued that we have produced, in his words, homo up to datum, total instant information, and all at oneness with the incredible advantages, say, of hypertext and other things, but at the expense of losing any sense of the whole, with our factoids pressing in on us every few seconds, losing any sense of the whole and losing any sense of what can, let alone must, be done about it, in other words, responsibility. And without the context and the whole, and without the responsibility of doing what is known, a true loss of wisdom in any biblical sense. So Boorstin says, we have produced homo optidatum, but homo optidatum is a dunce. The marketing revolution is perhaps the least noticed of these, but it surely means the triumph of style over substance. The two were once linked. The style was the outward expression of the inner character of something, whether a person or a period of architecture or whatever, the Gothic style, the Georgian style, the Romanesque style, or whatever. But the feature of our modern world where marketing has triumphed is that style is everything and substance is nothing. Again, you can see many applications of this. For example, the little Washington phrase, perception is reality. And in modern politics it is, and one of the reasons why there's no character and substance behind much of modern politics. But again, you can see the effect in the church. Studies show even in something as simple as response to preaching. How do people listen to preachers and judge preachers? Well, according to the anecdotes, according to the smile, according to the style and the persuasiveness, but almost nothing to do with what's said. And you can see that what's now called credibility, which is truly plausibility, what seems true because of appearances, is the dominant thing because of the triumph of style over substance. And if we look around American culture today, you can see that style is all important. For the individual, it's the main way of finding identity and belonging. So I wear these clothes and drive that car and sip this designer water, whatever, in order to express who I am. And the word style, as is often pointed out, is on more magazine covers than the word sex. Because it's the selling of identity and meaning and belonging at the individual level. At the corporate level, higher up, of course, it's just plainly selling. And style is the main avenue for selling goods, just as it is for finding identity for individuals. And we're in a culture which has increasingly divorced substance from style with enormous significance for the gospel. Proposition 7, or wherever we got to. Three main storm fronts of the brunt of modernity on the church. In many ways, these are extremely obvious, but I just want to draw out one implication. I would say the three main storm fronts of the brunt of modernity in the church are the United States, Japan, and Western Europe, simply because those are the three most modernized parts of the world. Now, if you just think for only a few seconds as to how the church is doing in those parts of the world, you'd have to say, in Japan, not very well today, and we have never done very well. Western Europe, and I speak as a Western European, we have to say with great sadness, the Church of Christ has won Europe twice and lost Europe twice, and we're not doing very well today. Which means that humanly speaking, underline that, humanly speaking, the challenge of living here is so significant, because here is the leading edge of modernity, and the church is still relatively, for various reasons, spiritual or historical or cultural, the strongest, spiritually, theologically, numerically, financially, and in various other ways. Now, I only underline that for this reason. Many American Christians think that when they see the problems, the only solution is bring in people from the third world. So yes, we're not doing very well. But if we just bring the brothers and sisters from Africa, with their freshness and their enthusiasm, their dedication, all will be well. Or bring the brothers and sisters from Eastern Europe who've gone through the fires of persecution, and all will be well. They have a courage and an intensity we've lost. But you can see the fallacy if you think for a few minutes. Maybe, yes, bringing over individuals. But long term, they are in the pre-modern parts of the world, and they have not been through the fiery brook of modernity. And the real test is the third generation. Incidentally, not only the third generation of modernity in these countries, but the third generation of some of them being here. And all the signs and studies show that many of them are blunted, to put it mildly, or cooled, let alone corrupted, long before the third generation. And our challenge is to face the full onslaught of modernity, theoretical and practical, and really practice the Lordship of Christ with integrity and effectiveness right where we are and not hanker for different days and different places that we think are better. Proposition 8. Three essential requirements for overcoming modernity. The first, profound knowledge and experience of transcendence as the deepest counter to secularization. For me, the heart of secularization, and it includes many things, is the secularization of consciousness. As historians point out, human beings have always lived in what we might call the ordinary world, 7 to 11 waking world, the world you can see and touch, measure, taste, weigh, and so on. People have always lived basically in the ordinary world. That's not new. But in the pre-modern world, they also lived in another world which was unseen but not only equally real, so decisive that they understood the ordinary world in the light of the other world. So things as mundane as farming or sex or business were understood in the light of the framework given by the other world. But the feature of our modern world and its secularized consciousness is that the ordinary world is the only world. Peter Berger says simply, we live in a world without windows, a world rather like the average modern university lecturer. Just the world you can see, etc., etc. You could put this many ways. Studies have shown that it's Western missionaries who ironically have taken secularism to the third world. The third world people may have had a pagan worldview in some parts, the spirit of the forest, the demons, the whatever. But at least it was a worldview of the supernatural that was there and living, if pagan and wrong. Whereas the missionaries in many cases have had a rather more Western view of the world where the only supernatural was language like prayer and the rest of the supernatural world was largely evacuated. And their whole mentality to life, fixing cars, arranging churches, was a sort of modern technical way which eventually introduced secularity into third world consciousness in decisive ways. Chesterton said many years ago, the average worldview of the modern person is like that of a slightly drowsy middle-aged businessman right after a good lunch. I know a friend who argues, Christian leader in this country, who argues that many modern evangelicals are atheists unawares. Not just a head knowledge, but a living experience of a transcendence to counter secularization, which is so strong and so insidious, is at the heart of the requirement we need of practicing the presence of God and knowing God in power today. The second requirement would be a deep integration in all our callings to counter the effect of privatization. The modern world has this relentless effect to separate private and public and create a dichotomy between the two, which hits at the heart of the integration of life under the lordship of Christ. The Muslims recognize this in their insistence, often in fanatical terms, of the Sharia law running everywhere. And surely this is the heart of the challenge for us as Christians. For them, it means a more establishmentarian approach, imposing it on all others. And our challenge in a pluralistic society is how still to live with the lordship of Christ in every part of our lives. I often think the problem in America is not that Christians aren't where they should be. That's partly the problem. There are some spheres of American life very characteristically underrepresented. For various historical reasons, not usually good ones, but genuine ones, we have fewer Christians than we should in the world of the universities, say, or the world of the media. In a few cases, that's the problem. We're not where we should be. In most cases, though, the problem is not that we aren't where we should be. The problem is we're not what we should be right where we are. And in many spheres like medicine or law or business, Christians are thick on the ground, but largely innocuous because of a failure to practice the lordship of Christ in real life. The third requirement is persuasion in witnessing and all communication to counter the effect of pluralization. If you look at our evangelism, many of Christian methods grew up in the 40s. they assumed a world of Christendom or semi-Christendom where most people talked Christian. People were therefore somewhat open, somewhat interested, somewhat needy in Christian terms, and these methods worked. But we move into a day increasingly secular in public life and pluralistic in private life when they simply don't work. And more these methods are ineffective, and there's a persuasionlessness gripping the church, which has been transferred from witnessing to politics, as you can see supremely in many of the ineffectiveness of the, say, the pro-life movement. Now, I think we've got to say here as reformed people, and I speak to myself too, in many ways we have the answers here, but we're not going out. There are parts of the reform movement, and I leave you to guess where they talk transformation like a storm, but actually keep it largely to themselves rather than engaging American society and doing the transformation. There are other parts, and closer to us on the East Coast, where there's a massive stress in apologetics, but it frankly doesn't go out and win people in the culture. And let's be honest, the reform movement is not very persuasive. And if we're to be true to our heritage, I think we've got to have a new commitment to truly being persuasive, not just in theory, but in practice. Because we are living in a most extraordinary moment. I think one could make the case that the post-Christian rivals to the gospel are in greater disarray than at any time for 500 years. As I go around the campuses, most of the post-Christian rivals to the gospel have no answers. There's an incredible nihilism and cynicism and irony, nothing to add at all. It's some of the pre-Christian movements like paganism and Hinduism, which are picking up many people. But the post-Christian answers have nothing to say. But at that very moment, we have little more to say either. And I think it's one of the tragedies that we're facing, a historic cultural moment of opportunity. And we as a church at large, including the are remarkably unpersuasive in practice. Parts are in theory, and a few are in practice, but most of us really aren't. And this is a day to move out in power. Proposition 9, the last one. Three grounds for unshakable confidence in the gospel despite all the challenges of modernity and civilization. I remember a seminar at Oxford back in the 70s. When we had a leading Christian sociologist, David Martin, and a leading Marxist philosopher, or philosopher of Marxism, who became a Christian, Leszek Kolakowski, discussing why Marxism would be bound to collapse, but why the gospel would flourish, however bad things were today. And these were their reasons. In other words, Marxism was becoming a declining force, captive to its own culture. The church was becoming a declining force, captive to its culture. But the gospel, they pointed out, had in its own truth something that meant it would never finally decline. And these were the three reasons they gave. That in the Word of God, we have a judgment that transcends history. So again and again, the gospel appears captive because the church is captive to a culture, to a period, to a generation, to a class, to whatever. Sometimes even the understanding of the word, the understanding, not the word, the understanding of the word itself is captive to a set of ideas of a particular culture or a particular class. But when that word itself speaks, nothing can hold it back. And in the Word of God, we have a judgment that transcends history, which means the Church of Christ is never finally captive to any Babylonian captivity. The second reason, that in the doctrine of sin, we have a doctrine of our own failure. Very few other faiths or ideologies have any realism like the gospel, that we are all often go wrong. And yet at the end of the day, it's that realism which is so healthy. Because whether we know it in our minds or we experience it again, once again in our lives, that's precisely what drives us the truth of who we are and back to the truth of who he is, and by grace, renewal is possible again. The third reason, in the history of Christian awakenings, we have powerful precedents for all that needs to be done. Here again, on this level, I'm particularly moved in Washington today. I've tried to follow the sort of scholarly discussion of revival for the last 15, 20 years. What's interesting in Washington is this. When I was a boy, when things looked really dark in evangelical circles, the final throw of the dice would be, but God can revive us. I hardly ever hear that today. It's always we can muster another 100,000 votes to besiege the Congress and so on. Interestingly, though, in Washington, many voices of those who are not believers refer to revival. For example, Irving Kristol, Jewish and somewhere between agnosticism and atheism, I'm not quite sure where he described himself there, but often he says, no political or legal solution will touch this problem. The answer in America will be religious revival, and it'll come from evangelicals. You can see evangelicals in the room startled to think that someone like this should say it of them when they've given up believing it of themselves. But it's moving how many American historians, just knowing the history of the awakenings here, don't rule out this possibility, which has been at the heart of the American story, let alone for us, at the heart of our knowledge of what God can do in Reformation and revival. I don't believe, as some do, that we're moving into a period where the Christian West will engage with these other civilizations in some great civilizational conflict like that. Samuel Huntington even believes that the next world war will be a civilizational conflict on that sort of scale. I think we'll see elements of that. And you can see in countries like Algeria now, some of the fault lines between modernity and some of the ancient civilizations like Islam. But I think far more likely is a future in which modernity will increasingly provide the one nearly global civilization. But within it, you will have an extraordinary pluralistic challenge where ancient religions, complete with cultures supporting them, will be in clashing at all sorts of levels in business, in schools, in education, at all sorts of levels in society. So we'll be moving into a time which kind of looks like culture wars on an international scale, which in many profound ways will be the challenge of Elijah and the prophets of Baal in our time. And I think we need to rethink through what that challenge will be and what it means to stand with integrity and effectiveness in our own day. Let me finish with a story which I underline is not a Christian story. We probably all have our heroes, and many of us in these situations would point to Martin Luther, the Diet of Worms, or whatever. Catholics point to Don John at the Battle of Lepanto. There are various precedents that inspire people when they think in these sort of grand ways. There's one that always moved me. It's not a Christian one. 480 BC. If you know the history of that times, Xerxes, the so-called King of Kings, had swept across the Hellespont and was marching down on Athens. But Athens was not the shining city that she became. She was a fractious little city-state which had an extraordinary capacity to annoy great powers, and she couldn't muster an army strong enough to face the Persians. There were over 100,000 of them, far, far more. But the Greeks together put 7,000 into the field, and they marched basically under the Spartan prince Leonidas up to face Xerxes with his immortal troops and so on. They chose that wonderful spot where the high mountains, 5,000 feet, come down almost to the ocean, where you can hold the pass. For 3 or 4 days, they held it. And Xerxes was infuriated. He sent in his crack troops, the so-called immortals, but the Greeks threw them back. And then on the fourth day, inevitably, they were betrayed. And when they woke up, they were surrounded. Persians everywhere. 7,000 against maybe 150,000. And Leonidas, realizing that all was up, he could only fight with so many, dismissed all but a few hundred, his own crack Spartan troops, known for standing and winning or just dying where they stood. And they chose a little hill, and they stood and they died to the last man. But just before they died, he sent away his last message. And you can see the statue there in Greece today, enormous, rather ugly statue of Leonidas. And on the plinth, his last message back to Sparta. Stranger, tell the Spartans that we behaved as they would wish us to behave and we're buried here. It's brief, it's laconic, it was courageous. Now the human heart resonates to courage like that. That's not what interests me. In an extraordinary way, as you look back, we are partly free today because they, in their time, stood in the line of freedom. Compare that with that passage in Ezekiel. I looked for a man to stand in the gap, and I found no one. I think we're going into a century when it won't be these grand heroic stands, but it will just be countless Christians in all sorts of ways, unseen and unsung, who know what the integrity and effectiveness of faith is. But it's not just standing against the modern world and secularism and so on as we've done. A day when the ancient civilizations will be reawakened and the spiritual and religious and cultural challenges they bring will be enormous. And by God's grace, we've just got to be faithful where each of us stand. Thanks. Over to you. Sure. Yeah. Chris. I think what I've heard, some of it's a little like the sort of Yellow Pages movement, a trifle simplistic. Some of it's really rather interesting. Overall, though, I think the challenge is there are an amazing number of Christians at the highest levels of business leadership, as there are in politics, but most of them lack a strategic vision of discipleship. So you can overwork the example, but the example of William Wilberforce is typical of so many of them. When Wilberforce, the best friend of William Pitt, the youngest prime minister in history, when he came to Christ, his instinctive reaction was, I've got to go to the ministry. Mercifully, a minister, John Newton, former slaver and so on, said to him, no, you stay where you are and ask God what you wants to do with you there. And a couple of years later, he wrote those immortal lines, God set before me two projects, the abolition of slavery and the reformation of manners. And when you look at that and you see the wave of revival of the Holy Spirit under Whitfield and Wesley and all the people of that generation, it was Wilberforce's privilege to lead people of the leadership class, the gatekeepers of their time, to really make their influence for Christ, which made an equally strategic impact. And in a way, I think that's where American leaders should be today. There are an amazing number of the captains of industry who have come to Christ or on the verge of coming to Christ, but the model's given them. I mean, there's one man who's a multi-millionaire, and he goes around everywhere teaching this ideal, that the wealthier you are, you slowly give more and more of your time to ministry. So if you're truly wealthy, you give 60, 70, 80% to ministry. Rather than doing the Wilberforce thing, where I am, what could I do in terms of the world situation, whatever it is? And I think that, so I'm encouraged by some of those movements that you mentioned. But I think we really should pray for the leadership class in this country, not in an elitist sense, but it's one of the least touched and most important because they are the gatekeepers. Should have Bill Edgar up to answer that one. He's much more of an expert than I on that, and ask him afterwards. Just one comment, and that is modernity tends to reduce both art and religion to the same thing, a consumer product. And that's part of the problem, I think, of the modern arts. I mean, quite apart from the philosophy that's driving this or that or the other, which is a separate problem, just art as itself is sort of reduced to a consumer product in this creeping commercialism, the market totalitarian of everything. As people warned at the turn of the century, when you see things purely in commercial, pecuniary, capitalist terms only, you're reducing the higher elements of life, where things have an intrinsic value, and you do them for the pleasure of what they are rather than for the payment of what they give. And the arts have suffered that same problem that religion has. You could say many, many other things, but I don't think modernity has a high place for art. In that way, it's very patronizing. It's a consumer product. Ask Bill about that. He's your man, just two seats away. Yeah. But in a sense, that's going back to what we always should have done. In other words, we realize now the mass approaches are very shallow. But then what do we go back to? What we should always have been at. So you look in the New Testament, and the modern buzzword is mentoring. But actually a word that gets closer is tutoring, apprenticing. Because, you know, the essence of, say, Plato, Socrates, Aristotle, and all that sort of philosophical thing was that the idea of apprenticeship was there were some things in life too deep to be put in words. So they could only be learned under a master, under his authority, in experience. Because even the master couldn't put in words, you had to pick it up from him. Now, of course, in the New Testament, that's far more profound. Jesus chose 12 to be with him. And I've often heard it's that middle clause in Mark 3, to be with him, to be sent out to preach. They had a privilege we don't have. Actually, that was the heart of the discipleship. And so Paul and Timothy and so on, that apprenticing notion's at the heart of it. Now, of course, it's much costlier because it can only happen the sharing of one life to another life rather than the sharing of words and books and broadcast things, which is easy but essentially shallow and ineffective. So yes, modernity actually forces us back to where we should have been all along, to true discipleship. Now again, there's a whole cluster of questions that flow out of that one question. Historically, I think it went something like this. And there's three broad deficiencies of discipleship in America. The first and oldest and most obvious is the privatization. So, you know, Christians are incredibly aware today. When I first came over in 68, I remember being booed at the mention of Ingmar Bergman film. And it was amazing how many things going on in the 60s Christians didn't know about or were just shocked by at long distance. Because by and large, most evangelicals certainly were heavily privatized. Their faith was privately engaging, publicly disengaged. Now, as a reaction to that, many after the 60s, woken up by the 60s, particularly after 73, Roe v. Wade and OPEC and Watergate and so on, went to the other extreme, politicized. We've got to be relevant. And politics is the most obvious way of being relevant and really making a difference and so on. And obviously, in a democratic society, political responsibility is a key part of Christian faithfulness. I'm not speaking against it. But they carried all sorts of problems. Jacques Ellul talked a long time ago about the political illusion of looking to politics to do more than politics could ever do. Or later, evangelicals like Chuck Colson warned of the same thing. So in the late 60s, the tendency was to confuse things with the left. We can all think of some of the stuff written in the then magazine Post-American, which became the Sojourners. You know, it was Christian but indistinguishable from some of the left-wing nonsense of the day. More recently, it's been far more towards the right and conservatism. If privatization in one word lacks a sense of the totality of Christ's lordship over everything, the politicization in one word lacks tension. Christians are so in to this cause or whatever, they're of. You could particularly see this in Washington, the starry-eyed ways people come up to Capitol Hill or the House or look to Newt Gingrich or whatever. You know, and you may have seen the Wall Street Journal article. It's written by a friend who's a Christian. Even Newt Gingrich can't save us. And it came out about 3 weeks ago, whatever it was. I saw some Christians read that. They were shocked. It's actually written by a Christian. They needed to listen to that because many of them were looking to politics to do more. And politicization, turning everything into political angle, actually grew out of the left in the 60s. And that's the tragedy. The third deficiency, I think, is what the Dutch call pillarization, but that's another story. So at the moment, the going danger is that one. And there are many, many illusions flowing around Washington still. I'm not against Christians in politics, of course. No, it's a good question. I'd put the question back to your professors, who, you know, that's much closer to their calling. But just a thought or two. Obviously, we've got to begin back where people are nurtured in Christ, whatever age, you know, growing in Christian families or being one in the student years, and teach them that to love Christ includes loving him with our minds right from the beginning. So we stem the anti-intellectualism, you know, right where it begins, in simple, basic, practical, and importantly, biblical terms. So we've got to start there. Now, interestingly, if you look at the campuses, many of the most anti-intellectual are in the best universities. In other words, they're reacting out of fear. You can go to some, I won't be rude about them, but I can think of a one of the best InterVarsity groups I've ever seen, for instance, is in a Midwestern university, which will be nameless, where, frankly, it's not quite as challenging as a Harvard, Yale, or Stanford. And so they walk tall, they think courageously, and so on. Whereas often you go to the elite universities and the Christians come huddling into their fellowship groups and love the spiritual, and they're afraid of the intellectual because they get mowed down. So we've got to give them courage. But here's the main thing I'd say. There are various ways put forward how we might win it. First, we've got to think one or two, maybe three generations. This is not going to be done in 2 years. You know, it's not going to be a quick series of seminars that are going to do it. This might take 75 or 100 years. We've got to think with that terms, like Wilberforce did. He reckoned it could take him his whole lifetime. It took, in fact, 50-odd years to win the abolition fight. We've got to think long-term for Christ in these sort of areas. But here's the suggestion. Here I'm partly following discussion that I had some years back with James Hunter. One way to do it, maybe the best way to start, would be to choose your best Christian scholars, by which I don't mean the most reputable thinkers, but people who have first-rate scholarly integrity in the secular campuses, who also have a vision for being there for Christ and a capacity to share it, and give them the money to gather around them, in effect, disciples. So, for instance, at the University of Virginia, James has done this. He's got a group called Contra Mundum. His PhD students, and he chooses just the very best. He really cares for them pastorally. So once a month, they have a dinner and then a discussion. And he guides them academically and guides them spiritually in ways to give them a vision so all their lives are going to be scholars for Christ, not just winning respectability for themselves, but to really make a long-term difference. And I think if we chose about 20 scholars in the country, there's plenty of money around, and said, you know, we will give you this money to have this and so on, and really built on the islands of hope, this would be one way of seeding the clouds in a multiplying way. Now, you could have many other suggestions too, but that's one. Now, I agree with you totally. You know, probably the first before Postman was Marshall McLuhan. You know, the medium is the message. Still, most Christians, I'm afraid, are not where you are. So if television's good or bad, it's whether the programs are nice or not. If it's bad, there's sex or violence or bad language. And you know the sort of people who critique the media, and you can read that, you know, this film had 103 swear words. You know, as if that's why the film is dangerous, or a sort of quantifiable view of evil. And you're right, the far subtler thing is the very nature of the medium itself in technology or advertising, whatever. You know, and I think this just requires incredible discrimination. In other words, I'm personally not a Luddite. David Wells, who's a great friend of mine, often describes himself as anti-modern. I'm personally not. We're here. Modernity's wonderful at many points, and it's disastrous at other points. You know, and we need to have constant discrimination to know what are the strengths, weaknesses, assets, liabilities, pros and cons of each thing we're in. Some of them, there's not much argument. Say, the telephone answering machine is a wonderful way to control the telephone. A lot of things are much more mixed. I mean, it's interesting just to watch the introduction of faxes in Washington. Oh, wonderful. And some of these poor congressmen are just deluged in just paper flowing out like a storm. You know, and you can see all the problems. We've each got to figure out what it does to us and then keep running it through a biblical grid. You know, for instance, I wrote the Gravedigger file at Bel Air Presbyterian in L.A., long time back, more than 10 years ago. And they asked me to do a critique of Bel Air and L.A. in the light of these sociological things. You know, it's rather easy to do because it's so extreme down there. You know, you could see all sorts of things. One of the very simplest was they were basically a freeway fellowship. But as with all fellowships like that, everything depends on voluntarism. There's nothing natural or involuntary or whatever about the community. It's all what you choose to do. And anything you can choose to do, you can choose not to do. And in a consumer culture, you could see, you know, people passing down the line in the church if they had an ethical problem. You could just shop around your group, and if you didn't like the advice here, you got another group. And you just saw the whole fellowship being constructed like that. They need to be made aware of what mobility and consumerism was doing to their ethics. Otherwise, it completely undermines something like accountability and community. So the challenge is always, we're in the world but not of the world. Be not conformed but transformed, which means we're always discriminating. Now, we're not always right, but it means a non-stop discussion and prayer and thought before the Lord with each other, so that we're able to weigh out what modernity is doing to us at this angle or that. So the television's different from the radio, advertising does this, and virtual reality does that. I mean, virtual reality, I'm fascinated by the discussion. You could have a new form of kind of cyber-Gnosticism. No, I mean, in a very profound way, where everything's up here in the head, and there really is disdain for bodies and all that sort of stuff again. And all the stuff that's probing this sort of coming Gnosticism, very, very interesting spiritually, as well as technologically. We just need to keep abreast of it and keep humble. None of us have all the answers, and God is sovereign. And so, you know, some people take all this far too heavily and seriously, and then they panic and get alarmed at the end. And the great thing is the Lord is God.